Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
We lost our humanity. We lost our dignity. We got punished for something we did not do.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells the story of the Black 14.
Our young lives were flipped upside down.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 20th of February, these are our main stories. Brazil is recalling its ambassador to Israel in an escalating row prompted by President Lula da Silva comparing the Israeli assault on Gaza to Hitler's extermination of the Jews. Relatives of the late Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, have been told that his body will not be released for another 2 weeks to allow time for further tests. Nigeria's currency, the Naira, has fallen to record lows against the US dollar as protests take place over rising prices. Also in this podcast,
we talk about one culture in Easter Island. And in the case of the Moai, Hua Hakananaia is one of the most important ones. It's also because it's our symbol in this island.
A campaign is growing for two of the famous Easter Island statues to be returned to the Polynesian territory after they were removed in the 19th century and taken to the British Museum in London. Brazil has recalled its ambassador to Tel Aviv, Frederico Maia, in an escalating diplomatic row following President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's controversial comments about the Israeli action in Gaza. On Sunday, he described the conflict as a genocide, not a war, which could only be compared to Adolf Hitler's decision to exterminate the Jews. Earlier on Monday, Israel effectively banned the Brazilian leader from visiting the country. I spoke to our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams, who's in Jerusalem, and asked him for more on what Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, said in response to Lula's remarks.
He, like every politician in the country, expressed absolute outrage and dismay at the comparison that President Lula appeared to be making, comparing the death of 29,000 people in the Gaza Strip to the gassing of 6 million Jews during the Holocaust. I don't know if President Lula was making a calculated remark, but if he wasn't, then he shouldn't be surprised at the reaction. And the way it was played out today was pretty unusual. They didn't just summon the ambassador for a reprimand behind closed doors. They did it at Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust Memorial, and they paraded the poor ambassador in front of the Book of Names. That is the vast collection of 6 million names that forms the centerpiece of the Yad Vashem Memorial, you know, with the press all there to record the ambassador's discomfort. They really wanted to drive home the sense of disbelief and outrage in Israel that such a comparison could possibly be made. President Lula, for his part, has now recalled the ambassador to Brazil for talks, so we don't quite know where it goes from here.
Yeah, it seems as though President Lula's doubling down, no intention of apologising. That obviously is going down extraordinarily badly with Israelis.
Well, yeah, I mean, this comes on the heels of the case brought to the International Court of Justice by South Africa accusing Israel of genocide in Gaza. So here we have another large country, a member of the BRICS group, essentially, you know, summoning the spectre of the Holocaust using terms like genocide when describing the actions of Israel's military in the Gaza Strip. This is something which is causing dismay in Israel, but also perhaps a sense that, you know, here we are with significant countries and chunks of populations around the world all feeling somewhat the same way about what Israel is doing in Gaza.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. On Sunday, the World Health Organization said the biggest hospital in southern Gaza was no longer functioning after a raid by Israeli forces. The head of the WHO, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said its teams had not been allowed to enter the Nasser hospital in the city of Khan Yunis. It's thought about 200 patients remain there with no power and not enough staff to treat them. To get an impression of the situation for medics in Gaza, Owen Bennett-Jones spoke to a doctor, Irfan Galaria, who recently managed to work in a hospital in the territory. Born and raised in Michigan in the US, he's a plastic surgeon now based in Virginia. He's just been to Gaza for 10 days to try to help the medics there. So, as he crossed into Gaza from Egypt, what were his first impressions?
Everywhere you looked, we saw tents, just a sea of tents. They were lining the streets, even in the roundabouts and at intersections. Wherever there was empty space, there was a home, an attempt to make a home.
Now, you went and worked for 10 days in the European Gaza Hospital, which is in Rafah, near the crossing point with Egypt. So just tell us a bit about that work. What did you do? What was it like?
Yeah, I worked and lived in the European Gaza Hospital in the operating room, and that's on the border of Khan Yunis and Rafah. And I was literally sleeping in my sleeping bag on the floor of the operating room preoperative holding area because there was no other place to sleep. So I worked alongside the only local plastic surgeon who was in the hospital. He estimates that he alone was responsible for caring for over maybe 300 of the 1,000 patients in the hospital. And daily, he averaged about 20 to 30 surgeries a day. So I was able to assist him. And these patients were of two types. One were patients who had new injuries, acute injuries from bomb blasts, machine gun fire, sniper fire. And there was a second subset of patients who had previous injuries and who were being brought back for secondary procedures, such as cleaning out wounds, removing additional shrapnel, trying to align a bone.
You talk about sniper fire. Now, the whole point of sniper fire is it's meant to be very sort of targeted and accurate. Who was getting hit by sniper fire?
You know, one morning, there was several elementary age children who were brought to the emergency room, all with sniper shot wounds to their heads. One of the doctors on our team, she was called to assist and was there to talk to the parents to hear their stories. She personally cared for at least three of these children. She tried to resuscitate them all, but they had died. And she remembers the first child that she tried to assist very vividly. She was a girl around the age of 6 or 7 who had a single small circular wound in her forehead. And her father was rushing and carrying her in while this child was unconscious and reflexively vomiting. And he was crying, "She's my only daughter. She's my only daughter." And the parents shared these stories from this incident, and they were all about the same. You know, the story was about 4 kilometers away from the hospital, tanks and occupational forces had withdrawn, and several of the families were then trying to return to their homes. And as they approached, snipers opened fire and shot several of them in the head.
And was it clear that these were Israeli snipers?
That is the assumption based on the experience that they had. These children all had single bullet-sized wounds or entry points in their head. They had no other marks of shrapnel or no other evidence of missile blasts.
And the Israelis say that these hospitals have been used by Hamas to shelter fighters and to store weapons. Now, you were in a hospital for 10 days, and I presume there were lots of people from the public there, so you wouldn't really, you know, taking shelter, so you wouldn't really know who everyone was. Did you see any weapons?
No, I did not see any weapons. I did not see any suspicious activity. There were no places in the hospital that were determined or deemed to be off limits for me. And so I did not have any suspicions or concerns of any military fighters, terrorists, or soldiers that were in the hospital.
That was Dr. Irfan Galaria. Well, the BBC tried to get the Israeli government and the IDF to respond to some of the allegations made in that interview, but they were unable to provide us with a spokesperson. The latest official figures on Israel's economy reveal it shrank by far more than expected at the end of last year. The country's Central Bureau of Statistics calculated, using what's known as the annualized basis, that activity, or GDP, dropped by 19% towards the end of 2023, the equivalent of a fall of 5% between October and December. Our chief economics correspondent, Darshini David, has this analysis.
The Hamas attacks on October the 7th and the subsequent war in Gaza appear to have dealt a blow to the Israeli economy almost as damaging as that seen at the height of the COVID pandemic. If the pattern over the final 3 months of 2023 were replicated over a year, what's known as an annualized measure, it would be equal to a fall in household spending of more than 25%, with spending on services more than halving. Businesses saw activity plummet, with construction almost grinding to a halt due to the call-up of reservists and falling numbers of Palestinian workers. The only area of expansion was in government spending, as defence expenditure soared. In November, the Israeli Central Bank estimated that the economy could recover and expand by 2% this year. But with the conflict more protracted than many first assumed, other economists reckon it could continue to extract a heavy price, with a further contraction, albeit less dramatic than over the last few months, unless there's an escalation in hostilities.
Darshini David. Next to Russia, and the spokeswoman for the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has said investigators will not release his body for another 2 weeks because they say further tests need to be carried out. Kira Yarmish wrote on social media that the investigators said an unspecified chemical examination would be carried out. Earlier on Monday, Mr. Navalny's widow, Yulia, accused the Russian authorities of holding on to his remains until the traces of what she called Putin's latest Novichok had disappeared. She released a video online vowing to continue her husband's fight for a free Russia. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, sent this report from Moscow.
For 3 days now, in a remote part of northern Russia, she has been trying to recover her son's body. But Alexei Navalny's mother was told that investigators won't release it. Mr. Navalny's spokesperson claimed the family had been informed a 14-day chemical examination of the body was required. Alexei Navalny's family, his supporters and Western leaders accused the Kremlin of murdering him. Today, President Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, reacted angrily to that. He described suggestions that the Russian leadership was behind Mr. Navalny's death as obnoxious and completely unacceptable. For the Russian opposition, the death of Alexei Navalny has left a huge void. But could his widow be about to fill that?
Привет. Это Юлия Навальная.
In a video statement recorded abroad, Юлия Навальная, bitter, angry, accused President Putin of killing her husband and vowed to continue his fight to change Russia.
Having killed Alexei, Putin killed half of me, half of my heart and half of my soul. But I still have the other half, and that tells me I have no right to give up. I will continue the work of Alexei Navalny, continue to fight for our country.
Yulia Navalny was in Brussels today, meeting European foreign ministers. Meanwhile, back in Russia, at a makeshift shrine to Alexei Navalny, we discovered that many of the flowers laid had been cleared away. And yet Muscovites were still coming here, laying roses and carnations, to honour the man who called for change, but would never live to see that.
Steve Rosenberg in Russia. Well, Mrs. Navalny has until now kept a fairly low profile. But with her powerful statements of defiance, she's emerged as the face of Russia's opposition, as our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
This is a deliberate and dramatic step into the political spotlight by a woman who had always played a supporting role. Yulia Navalnaya was often to be seen by her husband's side, at political protests, at court hearings, then at his bedside when he was poisoned in 2020. That was the first time she really spoke out, when she had to sound the alarm about her husband's health and demand clearance to fly him abroad for emergency treatment. Otherwise, she was a quiet presence, slightly mysterious, even frosty. Now Alexei Navalny is dead, his widow has taken on both his style and his cause. For Russians, her character and strength will be a revelation. The way she speaks when her grief is still so raw is both painful to watch and compelling. The couple's love was always apparent. Yulia Navalnaya says it's that and her fury that are driving her on. Bill Browder campaigns for economic sanctions against the Russian elite for human rights abuses, and he thinks Yulia Navalnaya has been underestimated.
The Navalny family is a political family. His wife is equally impressive, and she's still alive, and she's defiant, and she's going to carry on the fight. And I think Putin really miscalculated by killing Alexei Navalny.
But if Yulia Navalny is now putting herself forward as a political leader, then the question is, of whom? Vladimir Putin has spent more than two decades crushing all organized opposition. Navalny's political organization has been banned as extremist. Many of his team are in prison. Many more of them and his supporters have fled the country for safety. The piles of flowers at memorials all over Russia show that Navalny does still have many sympathizers. His widow has called on them to unite into a fist to punch at Putin's regime. But in life, Alexei Navalny did that the hardest of all, and he's paid a huge price.
Sarah Rainsford. The death of Alexei Navalny has drawn widespread condemnation from Western countries, who overwhelmingly directly blame President Putin for his death. But that's not all they blame him for. It's nearly 2 years since his full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and in recent days, Russian forces took the eastern town of Avdiivka, following months of grinding warfare, in which hundreds of soldiers on both sides have died. The BBC's Andrew Harding has just been to the front line in eastern Ukraine to talk to some of the civilians still there amidst the bloodshed.
A pontoon bridge across an icy river. We're driving back to Lyman, a frontline town in eastern Ukraine. It's a year since our last visit. Lyman is still in ruins. It was seized by Russian forces, then liberated in 2022. But the nearby front lines have barely moved since then. Alexander Rogovits, 74 now, is still here. He's surrounded by cats and still living in the wreckage of his old apartment block hit by Russian missiles. As he shows me the ruins, he says he's had a rethink about this long war.
I want peace, peace, peace.
So has your opinion changed?
Changed.
So this is interesting. He's changed his opinion over the course of the last year. Before he said Ukraine had to win this war. Now he's saying there's been too much death, too much suffering. He wants talks, even if it means giving up land. Peace is more important than victory. You can feel the weariness on the streets of Lyman. A crowd of pensioners queuing here for food. They barely react to the muffled boom of an explosion from the front lines. Our youth are being exterminated. If this continues, there'll be no Ukraine left, says 80-year-old Nadezhda. This war will go on for a long time yet, says Pasha, maybe hundreds of years. But it's not all gloom here. Council workers are out doing what they can. The war is too close for major reconstruction work, but they're trimming trees and paying pensions. And a younger generation is just getting on with life. School is mostly online, but every day children gather in these classrooms for help with homework and just to meet up. Laughing with her friends, 14-year-old Anya says, I've got everything I need here. I don't want anything else except peace and calm. A year ago, we found families hiding from the war in these dark cellars. And today, their apartment destroyed. The Dmitrenko family are still down here. But there's regular electricity now, a television showing the latest news. And water can be pumped from a well in the yard. Filling her bucket, Irina, an accountant just home from work, sounds quietly determined. We're waiting for victory, she says. We're all tired, but I don't see how we can negotiate with murderers. Lyman's mayor has moved his office for fear of more Russian missiles. He's now worried that America will stop supplying weapons to the Ukrainian troops protecting his town. We're fighting a monster, says Alexander Zhuravlyov. So we need more outside military help. Our soldiers are doing their best, but they're running out of guns and ammunition. Fresh snow blankets the town as we drive out. No one place can capture the mood in this vast country. But perhaps Liman, torn between despair and determination, gets somewhere close.
That report by Andrew Harding in eastern Ukraine. Finland plans to enhance its defence against a potential invasion by Russia by opening more than 300 new shooting ranges by the end of the decade, in a reversal of an earlier trend which saw many of them close. It's part of a push to involve its citizens more directly in its defence. Our Europe regional editor, Alice Adley, reports.
Finland shares a border with Russia which stretches more than 1,300 kilometres. Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago, Finland has become NATO's newest member and has been busy procuring defence equipment from around the world. Among other things, it's commissioned an air defence system from Israel and combat helmets from the USA. Helsinki also signed a $1.8 million contract last year with a Finnish firearms manufacturer for single-shot semi-automatic rifles. They'll be used to train citizens on how to defend their country from invaders. The number of voluntary defence courses for people to learn shooting skills has doubled in the last year, and there's also been a big increase in the number of applications for gun licences. The government's plan is to provide around 1,000 outdoor shooting ranges for target practice. A spokesman for the Defence Training Association, the MPK, says the desire to participate in national defence is strong. His comments on social media are accompanied by pictures of Finns training on firearms in the snow. The initiative, which will rely on the community's willingness to participate, is aimed at safeguarding Finland's sovereignty.
Alice Adley. Still to come.
They are buying household goods. They are even paying tuk-tuk drivers through Paytm. Even for a street food, they are paying through Paytm apps.
Now, one of the biggest online payment companies in India has come under the radar of the central bank.
When you see Iran close up, you realise just how complex a political landscape it is.
The Global Story. Smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story.
It seems that Iran's strategy at the moment is to increase the tension in the Middle East.
Every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service.
When Israel does agree to a ceasefire in Gaza, Iran will then worry about Israel then turning its sights towards Iran again.
The Global Story. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Next to Nigeria. The Nigerian currency, the Naira, has fallen to new record lows against the US dollar, while the stock market posted its biggest one-day fall in more than a year. Well, these latest economic crises come as protests were held in the southern city of Ibadan against high inflation and the rising cost of living. Similar demonstrations were held in northern Nigeria 2 weeks ago. These people say they're badly affected by the high inflation.
You cannot get food that is less than 1,000 naira. You have to have 1,000 naira or more to get food in Ibadan. And the electricity too is so bad. You've not bought the light for like how many days now? You've not been having light. And the heat too is too much for us.
Primarily, I believe Nigerians are protesting because of the high cost of living, the increasing hardship Nigerians go through every day. For me, the things we used to buy before are almost three times double the prices now.
Luke Jones heard more from the BBC Africa business reporter Nkaichi Obonu, who was in the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos.
There are about two major things that are driving the cost of living in Nigeria. First is the exchange rate. Now, a lot of people depend on foreign exchange to either import finished goods or to import raw materials that would be used in local production. Because of the scarcity of the US dollar in the country, a lot of people have been going to the black market, which is the parallel market, to source foreign exchange. And this has caused a huge demand for the US dollar. And so people are getting their foreign exchange at crazy rates across the country. For instance, at the close of trading today, Monday, the dollar closed at about 1,719 naira. It's the highest, record high in decades. It has never been this high.
Gosh. And also there's been some upset about the withdrawal of fuel subsidies as well. Explain that and what impact it's having.
Of course. The second reason is the price of fuel. Now, Nigeria imports over 90% of its fuel needs because it cannot refine fuel locally. Its refineries are not working.
Nkechi Obonu reporting. Now, when you have to pay for something, do you use cash or an app? If you're in India, many people have started making online payments through what are called digital wallets. Paytm is amongst the largest wallets operating in the country, but it's now in trouble with India's central bank. Davina Gupta heard more from the BBC's Archana Shukla, who's in Mumbai.
Paytm is India's one of the leading digital payments company. In fact, they are the ones who revolutionized making payments through just a click on your phone. You know, people started using the app to make a range of transactions. They are buying household goods. They are even paying tuk-tuk drivers through Paytm. Even for a street food, they are paying through Paytm apps, Paytm and similar apps, and paying their utility bills like power or mobile phone payments and the other sorts of payments. So all of this is powered by a digital wallet. Essentially, it's a small bank account, almost like a bank account in which people can receive deposits, they can keep money, they can make all the payments by scanning a QR code using their mobile phones as their identity. Merchants at their end also have digital wallets. They also have accounts where they're receiving these payments. So essentially, it's everything is happening in a digital domain, and all the payments transactions are happening, you know, through just a click of on your mobile phone.
And we're talking about some 300 million plus users just with this particular app. So what went wrong then?
Paytm started a Paytm Payments Bank, which can take deposits of up to $2,400. It can sell something like an insurance product or loan products through other third-party banks. So they started this bank, but in the last few years, there have been multiple times when the central bank has raised objections in how they've been doing the business, because there are concerns that this could lead to money laundering as well. That's why the Reserve Bank of India asked them to stop all banking services.
What happens now?
Now, because of the central bank's ruling, which doesn't allow them to do any banking services, they are transferring all this back-end work to another brick-and-mortar bank called the Axis Bank, and that will become the back-end bank. So about 50% of all merchant accounts on Paytm Payments Bank will need to be transferred onto this brick-and-mortar Axis Bank.
Archana Shukla in Mumbai. Julian Assange, the founder of the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks, begins what could be his final court hearing in London today to appeal against his extradition to the United States. The case against him goes back to 2010 and the release of US classified information on the WikiLeaks site. Just 2 years later, in 2012, Mr. Assange sought refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He spent 7 years in that building before emerging to face criminal charges and has been in an English prison since then. Julian Assange's wife, Stella, has been speaking to my colleague, Michelle Hussein.
This could very well be the final hearing for Julian in the UK, because if he loses this round, there is no possibility for further appeal in this jurisdiction. And that means that the UK Home Office will then move to extradite him. And we know that in other cases, that has been a matter of 24 hours. We are hoping that we'll have time to apply to the European Court of Human Rights and try to get an emergency injunction to stay that extradition. But at the moment, it's so uncertain and the stakes are so high. If he's extradited to the US, he won't survive it ultimately. So we need to stop it. That's my reading of how things are going to go.
How is he now? Because it's been, what, nearly 5 years in Belmarsh high security prison. How's he doing?
Well, it's very difficult for him. Obviously, this period is extremely stressful. He doesn't sleep. He loses his appetite and he knows that anything could happen.
He has the support of his own government, doesn't he? The Australian government, including the Prime Minister, who wants the US and the UK to bring this to an end. Could the UK government bring it to an end? Do they have that within their power?
Well, look, this extradition request should never have been accepted by the UK government because it's an extradition for political offences under the Espionage Act, and that is prohibited under Article 4 of the US-UK extradition treaty. So it should never have even gone to the courts. The previous government was wrong to accept it. And of course, the new Home Secretary could review that decision and reach the correct conclusion that it is in violation of their own treaty with the United States.
Why do you think that hasn't happened?
Well, this is a political case. It's a politically motivated. The subject matter, which is publishing evidence of state criminality of the country that's trying to extradite Julian, is political. It came about during Trump administration, who wanted to use Julian's case as a precedent to be able to go after the press under the Espionage Act. This is an unprecedented case. The Espionage Act has never been used against a publisher for receiving information and possessing it and communicating it to the public. And let's remember that Julian is not the whistleblower here. That was Chelsea Manning who gave Julian the material, who gave WikiLeaks the material so it could be published. And there's no question about the public interest of that material, which evidenced war crimes, torture, criminality, and so on.
And the Biden administration has continued this, and it seems that are determined to continue with it, despite what the Australian government has asked them to do. There are some MPs supporting your husband, but not that many. And I wonder if you look back on that period in the Ecuadorian embassy, the 7 years that he spent there trying to avoid the extradition request by being there, and think now that that was the wrong thing to do, and that is why you haven't got as much political sympathy as you would have hoped for.
Well, it's easy to look back now and say, well, maybe things would have been different. Even before that, Chelsea Manning had been in prison for 7 years. There was a lot of very threatening statements coming out of the United States, calling Julian a terrorist and so on. And that's why Ecuador, when they made their determination, it was based on Chelsea Manning's treatment in U.S. custody, which the U.N. Special Rapporteur on torture said amounted to cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment. And actually, the new U.N. Special Rapporteur just last week issued a statement saying Julian should not be extradited from the U.K. because he risks torturous treatment in the United States.
That was Julian Assange's wife, Stella. Now to Easter Island, a remote Chilean territory in Polynesia. Its native name is Rapa Nui, and it's famous for hundreds of statues created by the early Napa people that populate the island. That is, except for two, which lie in the British Museum in London. They were taken in 1868, and the museum is now facing an online campaign to get them back. On Sunday, the museum said it had to deactivate comments on its social media pages after they were overrun by campaigners. Paul Henley spoke to one man who wants the stone monuments returned. He's Sebastian Power, the former tourism chief on the island. He says the statues, or moai, are important to their culture.
For us, it's our ancestor. I need to be clear with this. We don't talk about one archaeology staff, the British Museum, they have for us. We don't talk about one culture who was disappeared and they lost the language. We talk about one culture in Easter Island who will still to believe in our ancestor, will still to believe in our moais and the reason why we created it. And in the case of the Moai, Hoa Hakananaia is one of the most important ones, not just because it's unique in the way how they make and the materials they use, it's also because it's our symbol in this island.
Can you explain what the statues look like? I know they're a very famous symbol of Easter Island. Perhaps you could just try to explain those who aren't familiar with the look of them.
First, if you take a look at the back of this Moai, they have petroglyphs of about the last age of Easter Island, about the age of the Burman. So we can say it's the only symbol can explain you both age, the age of the Moai and the age of the Burman competition, the two most important ages in the story of the island. And it's the only one from the 1,041 Moais, they exist in the island and outside, is the only one in these conditions. And second, if we're thinking about the line time of the story of Easter Island, since British, they took this Moai, the old belief of the tradition of the Burman competition is finished. It's exactly the same age. It's the age when it starts the Christian age. So for us, it's one of the last important symbols. And when British, they took this Moai from this island, the most important last belief of the island is disappeared.
Sebastian Power, the former tourism chief of Easter Island. And that's about it for this edition of the Global News Podcast. There'll be another edition later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.